That's Philippe, our general moderator, and a special session moderator.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
This is Allison Holcomb. You all know Allison Holcomb. I've known Allison for 11 years-ish, roughly. Obviously, it's just delightful to be here, actually, after all those years at HempFest and working together on stuff. So, Charlo, is that Charlo? I'm right here. Hi there. Sid. Wonderful. Oh, great. Usually we have, gender representation imbalances on the male side. This is an awesome panel, but actually four-fifths female, and the only male is missing. Lee Berger, please. Lee. Okay. Awesome. So, still wearing my Rasta bag, huh?
Humid.
How many people were here yesterday? Excellent. So glad it's drier today. So this is, I think, a very timely... Hi, Lee.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. Dominic.
Yeah. That's Philippe. Yep. Now, I want you guys to know that there's like a... I didn't choose the topic, but I think the topic, as it has been presented to the panelists, is an really interesting one that provides actually kind of a focused way to address things. So the title is Can a Bigotry? Right? If we've had legalization, why are we still fighting? So what I've asked actually each of the panelists to do is to, because that title really focuses things, is to identify for the audience what they think Can a Bigotry means or is supposed to mean, and then also address, you know, in whatever way they choose, you know, a potential, this sort of straw conflict that's been set up. Okay, we've got legalization. Do we all understand legalization to be the same thing? And why are we still fighting? So what actually, there's this contradiction in, you know, the presumed unity of cannabis or the presumed unity or homogeneity of the way cannabis culture is presumed. There are a lot of different ways that you can approach this, and each of our speakers today, I think, will offer you their own unique approach. So, if it's all right with you.
It's not a straw contradiction. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's not a straw contradiction.
Yeah.
It's not a made up thing.
Why are we coming to
HempFest if we've already got it legal?
A rhetorical device.
Oh, all right.
How about if I use that word instead? Rhetorical device.
You can use whatever word you like.
Yeah. Sorry. Straw contradiction is certainly the wrong term. I meant rhetorical device to be able to ask a question that is focused.
Okay.
About, you know,
that's topic. Better.
Yep.
Thank
Sound
you.
Good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Lee, actually I'm going to start with, since we've got four-fifths women, I'm going to start with women at the front and work our way back. So Sid, you'd like to start us off?
And I can stay seated?
You can absolutely stay seated.
All right. I think that cannabigotry is a really vague term and kind of manifests itself in a lot of different ways throughout society, pretty much in any way that you can be discriminated against, people experience cannabigotry. I think that my situation, I was fired as a local news anchor because I had THC in my system, even though I came to work sober every day, is a really good example of cannabigotry, because even though it is legal now in Oregon and a handful of other states, I, as an adult, was not able to use it in my free time and also hold my job. I think that, for me, I see a lot of this stemming from a double standard with the accepted and encouraged vices, you know, specifically alcohol. My coworkers were allowed to use alcohol in their free time and then come to work. However, I was not allowed to use cannabis in my free time. So we see this in all areas of society, but for me, when it comes to employee rights, that's what I want to draw attention to. If we're all adults and it's legal, why can't we choose to use THC or, you know, marijuana and have THC in our system in our free time? It just doesn't make sense, and we need to draw attention to that.
That's a really nice focus connected directly to your story. If you would actually tell the audience really quick a little bit about your story. This is the first time I'm meeting you, but I know that you're a Eugene media anchor who was fired. So go ahead and tell that story real quick.
Basically, it was corporate policy. I was filling in as a reporter that day, and I was in a minor fender bender. I tapped the bumper of the car in front of me, so I was forced immediately to take a drug test. And when I failed due to THC, even though my news director and assistant news director were fighting for me and all of my coworkers who worked with me every day and knew that I was, you know, completely sober and was a good employee, wanted me to keep my job, but then it came down to corporate policy, just deciding it's not worth the risk. She had THC in her system. You know, someone who did not know me in another state made the call to fire me. And I just, I was very frustrated, and it just, like I said, it didn't make sense to me, and the double standard there seemed very unfair, the kind of bigotry and being discriminated against with the drug testing policy. So I want, even though it's completely legal, I feel what they did was morally wrong, and so I feel like we need to draw attention to this because, and yes, it's legal, but it's not fully legal.
So discrimination in the workplace is a really clear connection to cannabigotry, the concept, and the fact that even after legalization, there's still work to do with labor policy, right? So, Charlo, if you would like to go next, if you want to make a brief self-introduction as well. I have actually never met you before.
Well, I'm Charlo Green. I am also a former news anchor. I quit my job last November. F it, I quit was the thing. So I became an activist. We fought really hard. We legalized recreational use in Alaska. Absolutely. And yeah, it's awesome. And we're still fighting up there. So I thought I could speak to the unique experience that we're going through. And hopefully, if you're in a place that has, I guess, pending legalization, you can learn from this. But I don't know if we realized that when we legalized recreational use, we gave the prohibitionists that had been running the state and the legislature the power to make new laws. Yeah. And so now they're using that to, it's almost as if they're trying to shrink the industry before it has a chance to begin. They're trying to delay things. I mean, it was less than a week after the vote passed. It wasn't even certified yet when one of our city council women announced that she wanted to ban it in Anchorage, which has about half the state's population, to just outright ban it, less than 7 days after we all voted to legalize the recreational usage. So we're going through a lot of them now also, I guess, denying the existence or the benefit of medical marijuana. So instead of giving the patients the medicine that they had been waiting for since we passed medicinal usage back in 1998. Now they're saying, well, we're not even going to put up any dispensaries. You guys are gonna pay the same taxes that all of the recreational stores are gonna have to go through, and we're just not even gonna deal with that. And anyone looking to help out the medical marijuana industry, you guys are gonna be banned from getting any sort of license, period, point blank.
Right. So to clarify, if I boil this down, what you've just described is cannabigotry as applying to patients in particular.
Right.
So, but also, of course, your story actually has parallels to SIDS and also the worker rights thing as part of your personal story as well, right? But then you've also got the local politics aspect.
It's a lot.
So it's, you know, to what extent do you think that, you know, those local, you know, jurisdictions were sort of ready to act? Had they been acted upon by their constituencies? Like, was the cannabigotry generalized in the population that gave the politician that support? Or was the politician deciding to do something to try to get support from an imagined sort of bigoted population?
Well, I think it's, we are the first red state to pass any sort of recreational usage measure. So it's the conservative majority that wants to keep the status quo as if it were before we passed the vote. They never expected all of us would show up and finally pass. This was the third try at this. So advocates have been fighting for so long. I think it was something that they just figured, well, they didn't show up the last time, they didn't show up the time before. Then F and I Quit happened and they couldn't ignore it, and everyone showed up. And we passed it by such a small margin that every vote count, and I don't think they were ready for it. So now they're kind of kicking and screaming into the future.
The mandate was very, there was a small margin essentially for the mandate for it to happen, so potentially a lot of...
About 47% voted
yeah,
no.
Yeah. Incredible. Thank you.
Yeah.
Stephanie Viskovich, who actually wrote me a really nice email preparation here. Really excited to hear if you could share with the audience Can of Bigotry and your take on this. We've got patients, we've got in the workforce, I'm sure we've got other places to go.
Sure. So even though we have legalization, we don't have complete freedom. And so people are arguing over, well, what freedoms matter more than the next guy's, when that really shouldn't be the issue at hand. Everybody should have equal freedoms on all playing fields. But we don't have that. And what we have here, and the only thing that I can really speak to of my knowledge is what I'm immersed in every single day and what I see as firsthand knowledge in Washington State, which is a legalization system for adult recreational use and a pre-existing medical system that was implemented, that now you're having two different defined users when before everybody was just a pothead, you know, regardless of what they were using it for. So now they're trying to figure out battling grounds. Well, gee, if it's legalized, then why can't I pass a joint to my friend without it now having these major repercussions? And opening this pathway, like you were saying, in Alaska, it's like, okay, well, they're trying to smother the chance of growth in the community from the people that have the most experience and knowledge on these plants before it can actually flourish. So what's happened here is we've had implementation adult use and a structured source of implementation from seed to sale to make sure that there's no black market exploited cannabis transactions happening. And it's forced our politicians to take a closer look at medical cannabis and say, okay, well, if we can structure this in a way for adult recreational use, why can't we structure this in a way where we feel it's safe from a public safety standpoint for patients? So it makes sense that they're trying to breach the gap to a certain extent. But at the end of the day, what is happening is you're seeing some people that have been doing a really good job and doing their due diligence, testing all of their cannabis before it goes to patients ever, making sure that they do their research and their homework about different ratio aspects of CBD to THC under different circumstances. And whereas talking about it is a big no-no, well, talking about it at all is what has stopped a lot of activists from being activists in the first place, because they're too afraid of what might happen if they stick their neck out, because nobody else is doing it. So coming up to the point where we had adult use in Washington State, for two decades, medical patients had the option to speak out about this, but the medical community is such a very small community. And when you look at the definition of a medical patient in the state of Washington, you have to either be terminally ill or permanently debilitated, which really compromises that individual specifically from being able to give it their full effort, and they're the minority anyways. So legalization with adult use has kind of opened it up for more table talk, which is pressing some issues. And right now, the biggest tug of war I'm seeing is between medical patients wanting to have access to medicine that they need to sustain their well-being on a daily basis that is not going to be available for them, even if it's in the interim. These people depend on their medicine so heavily that they're scared. They're scared, and they're scared to speak up, and they feel like now they don't have a voice because their pockets aren't deep enough to get enough attention. So that's where I'm seeing the majority of that bigotry going on. When really this wouldn't even be an issue if the fear factor was taken out of it. If we could educate people better about medical marijuana without the fear of talking about it in the first place, and oh God, what's going to happen if I do? So, in the interim, cannabigotry stems from having these different niche groups within the entire community that are looking at it from a micro level instead of a macro level. So if you were to look at the issue of descheduling cannabis out of a Schedule 1 substance, removing it from that list entirely, then the fear's gone. And then we can have open discussion. And then we can have open research and education to be able to figure out those implementations.
So much in here to unpack. I don't want to occupy your time, but I just want to... In terms of the bigotry part of it, one thing that you've introduced here is something to do about it, which is, you know, how do you address bigotry? You take a cannabis out of it, you know, like, well, what are our strategies for doing that? And then you want to sort of, you know, adapt that as you understand, you know, the phenomenon of cannabis bigotry, however you understand it. And again, we're getting a number of different approaches to it. Interestingly enough, you know, explicitly, you know, race hasn't been brought into this too much. I suspect the next person might be bringing that up. Allison?
That's right. Thanks, Dominic. Can everyone hear me okay? I don't know if this mic is that all right? Sound? Okay. A little bit closer. Get really close to the mic. Is it, pull it off?
We can't hear you.
That's better? Okay, great. This is all right? Perfect. Okay. So the term cannabigotry is really interesting to me. When I first read it, I wasn't really sure what to make of it. And here's my concern. I think that the term cannabigotry suggests that the bigotry that we're dealing with is really about the plant. And it's really not. That is not the history of marijuana prohibition. It is not a fear or a hatred of the cannabis plant. It is a fear and a hatred of people, and specifically people of color, brown people and black people. If we look at the history going back to the early 1930s, it was the first stories that newspapers were running about the Mexican loco weed turning these immigrants to our country during the Great Depression into crazed murderers and rapists. And then when Harry Anslinger learned that there were also black jazz musicians in New Orleans that were using this drug, that became a very convenient vehicle to spread that racist propaganda from the Mexicans who were competing for white jobs to the African Americans who, you know, might be competing for white women, for example. So the history about cannabigotry, around bigotry, is not about the plant. If we move forward, even today, in 2006, Katherine Johnson, a 92-year-old grandmother, was shot and killed in her own home over a botched search warrant. And the officers planted marijuana in the house to try to cover up their shoddy investigation and what amounted to the execution of an innocent woman. In 2013, at the trial of George Zimmerman, the judge presiding over that trial allowed in evidence of Trayvon Martin's marijuana use because, you know, maybe that Trayvon Martin, of course, was unarmed, teenager walking home in his own neighborhood. And the judge reasoned that perhaps the marijuana somehow skewed his judgment and contributed to his death at the hands of a neighborhood watch captain. Just this week, Charnicia Corley, a woman in Texas, was pulled over, stopped by a white deputy in Texas at a gas station who claimed that he smelled marijuana in her car. And when he searched her car, he couldn't find any. And so then he proceeded to initiate a cavity search in the parking lot of a gas station on the side of the road in Texas. When a female deputy came and started conducting the search, which consisted of Charnicia being asked to take her pants down in the parking lot, and this female deputy started inserting her fingers into Ms. Corley's vagina, and Ms. Corley objected, they called another deputy to hold Ms. Corley forcibly so that she could, in effect, be raped in public. This morning, I read in the news that HempFest has adopted Jimmy Romans and George Martirano as sort of mascots of this year's movement and the need to continue doing marijuana law reform. These two men are serving life sentences for marijuana, and that is not a fate that anyone should face. But these two men both happen to be white. And it's concerning to me that at a time when we have a nationwide conversation going on right now about police violence against our African-American brothers and sisters, about institutionalized racism that is a legacy of our history's unreconciled history of slavery, the legacy of slavery, when we're talking about mass incarceration and how we're rounding up swaths of our population for things that shouldn't be crimes, that we're not being better allies to the people that this bigotry is really all about. Just this last weekend, we had a very visible example of Bernie Sanders coming and trying to speak, and activists from the Black Lives Matter movement coming up to shut him down, basically on the grounds that the most liberal, progressive candidate in the presidential race right now is not talking about racial justice in the midst of everything else that's happening in the world, in our country. So I want to suggest to you, first off, let's keep in mind that the marijuana law reform movement is viewed by the outside world as being predominantly white, and predominantly about white people fighting for the right to get high. I don't think it's about that. I think it's about fighting to stop the government from using your choice of substance as an excuse for institutionalized racism, as an excuse for rounding up three times as many black people who use marijuana as white people that use marijuana, even though we use marijuana at the same rates. And I want to suggest to you that if we're going to be good white allies to our brothers and sisters of color who need our help, then we need to rethink whether we're really talking about cannabigotry or whether we're really talking about institutionalized racism, a history of unreconciled differences in poverty, education, economic opportunity, and the way that we use the criminal justice system to justify what is in fact just the perpetuation of racism in our country. Thanks.
Thanks, Allison. Eloquent as always. Really powerful reminder that when we talk about bigotry of any sort, usually we should first check in the mirror, right? She is encouraging cannabis culture to do so, and I certainly think that's a great thing to do. So last but not least, Lee Berger.
Hi. Would you like to? Good morning. I'm excited to be on the first panel of the HempFest in the Hemposium, and have to start off by reminding people that munchies save lives as we sit here in the Rick Smith Hemposium. I'm a lawyer. I live and work in Portland, and I work statewide. I've been talking about cannabigotry for a couple of years now and thought I had coined the term, although I think others have as well. I think what Allison describes pre-legalization cannabigotry, and what I've been focused on is post-legalization bigotry. And an interesting thing from just listening to this panel is how different things are in Alaska and Washington and in Oregon. The other thing I want to mention preliminarily is that a thing that always disappoints me over the last several years coming to HempFest is the animosity with which people on our small team disagree with each other. Allison and I disagreed a lot about certain provisions of 502, but we didn't burn any bridges, at least as far as I'm concerned. And I think that there's far too few of us friends to have that level of animosity. On a personal level, I've experienced cannabigotry this way. I'm a criminal lawyer by training. I've been looking after patients and their providers for the last 20 years and helped draft both the Medical Marijuana Act and the adult use law, which, by the way, Charlo, I prefer to recreational. When I recreate, I recreate. And when I use responsibly, I use responsibly. And I just think we ought to be, I know, Dominic, that we disagreed about the other language. Language is important to me. They're my tools, and I just really want to.
That was just my sloppiness.
Sorry, I don't think so. Because it ties in with this other conflict that needs to fucking end, please, here in Washington. You guys work this out. A lot of it has to do, I think, with the differences between how developed the medical marijuana program is. On the one hand, it sounds like in Alaska there weren't any dispensaries.
No.
Here in Washington, there are unlicensed and unregulated dispensaries. In Oregon, when we legalized, we have licensed and regulated dispensaries. Not quite as far along as Colorado when they legalized, but that makes a world of difference in the sense of the limitations on how they inhibit, and by they I mean the legislature, inhibit what it is that patients having safe access, which is really what you know, here in Washington now it's a felony, I guess, if you have a collective that's distributing. What?
Is it like a new felony?
It's a felony?
It's always been in the Supreme Court, just recognized.
It's always been.
It's a either way, it's a felony in Oregon to be compassionate, to collectively cultivate marijuana and distribute it to patients. You know, and that has to do with it being unlicensed and unregulated. So about 2 years ago, I started, I moved my office out of my house, created a law firm, Oregon Cannabis Business Compliance Council. And I went looking for an office space, and I had to go through all these, you know, she wanted to know all these numbers about whether I could pay or not, and I had to sublet one of the offices because there was an extra office more than I needed. And at the very end, she said, well, it's just one thing, but it's a deal breaker. I said, what's that? She said, you can't use Oregon Cannabis Compliance Council. You have to use Leland R. Berger, attorney at law. I said, why is that? She said, it might offend other tenants. I said, no, it wouldn't. She said, yes, it would. I said, that's bigotry. She said, no, it's not. I said, suppose I had chosen to champion the rights of gays and lesbians and transgender people and called myself Homosexual Law, LLC. She said, well, that's different. And the answer is, no, it's not. What cannabigotry is, at its base, is they don't like our kind. And while I appreciate the work the ACLU did in identifying the racist nature of the drug war, even in Eugene, in Sid's town, if Ngayo and I and Allison and Sid were walking down the street, Ngayo would most likely get arrested pre the end of prohibition. That, you know, one out of every four, where the population is so different, but where the population is, the industry population is primarily white, although there is a minority cannabis industry association now. I'm really excited about that. You can find that online. It's a guy, Jesse, who is a co-owner of a dispensary in medical dispensary in Portland. That's a big part of that. But industry, which, you know, I get how it feels like we legalized so that white people could get rich while black people got in prison. I understand that, and I'm hopeful that it's expanding. But the banning of the industry in places like Fife, Washington, and places like Cave Junction, Oregon, the bill that came out of the legislature that that allows municipalities to ban all licensees except for medical cultivation. The bans that are going on is based solely on bigotry. When I spoke with the Medford City Council, they said, "Well, you know, it's going to take us some time, and we're worried about this and that." And I was like, "You know, there were towns in the South that didn't like." Suddenly, when they had to go from having two water fountains to having one water fountain, but it's the same thing. They said it's not, you know, I think it is. So for me, the cannabigotry is primarily in employment, housing, and in banning industry.
So the denial of rights on the basis of one's stigmatization as a cannabis user, producer, consumer, industry person, culture person, what's the unifying thing here? I mean, cannabis as a word obviously refers directly to the plant, but in terms of bigotry, you usually have to have kind of a, you know, like a population that's generally kind of like got a characteristics that like they go together somehow.
I agree with the part of what Allison said about that we're viewed as, you know, fighting for our right to party. And I think that when I say they just don't like our kind, I mean they just don't like what they think are stoners, and it's because they haven't met responsible cannabis users like Charlo and Sid, who get fired for being not impaired at work and
for no other reason than
fuck it, I quit. Right?
Exactly.
A tremendous act.
Do you want to weigh in, Charlo or Sid?
On the basis of race and how it affects all of us, I think it's beyond just what it's done for us. I think a lot of people are afraid of what we can do as a people once we get
to the end of marijuana prohibition, once we realize how much more powerful we are and that we've been in the seat to control our lives, we just haven't been brave enough to stand up and demand that we have that power back. I think that's something that drives this blind fear and want to keep things as they are, even though people know that people are dying without their medical marijuana and that people are getting locked up left and right over a plant. I think it's the fear of what we can do that's also driving this blind hatred. Is that what bigotry is? It's just a blind...
I think Ghalib actually posed it in actually a pretty good, concise way. Could you repeat repeat that again for the audience?
Which
it
one was that?
They don't want our kind around.
Bigotry is they just don't like our kind.
They just don't like our kind.
Which is
definitely that applies to pretty much any kind of stigmatization based on difference. It's racial, yeah, definitely. But the history of race is not actually just about color. It's about constructing difference in society and people who can be trusted to govern themselves and people who have to be disciplined in other ways, right, for Foucault. So, Stephanie.
I'm just going to say real quick, a lot of this fear and bigotry and them just not liking our kind comes from misconceptions of poor information and lack thereof. So if we could open up the ability to do more research and learn about these things, I don't think people would be so blindly ignorant to just not like our kind if they had a better understanding as to what the capability of this plant truly is.
I'll also add just that I don't think it's also just the research. I think that's a really important aspect, but I think it also just has to do with a lack of exposure, kind of like Lee had just said. There's not enough examples out there of really what I believe is the average cannabis user, which is someone who is responsible and, you know, just the average American, not any sort of kind that is out there. The label that's out there is wrong in my opinion, but there are too many people who can't speak out about it for fear of losing their jobs or fear of losing their friends or families or, you know, going to jail. So it's exposure.
It's a reproducing cycle, is that the fear keeps it in the closet and it being in the closet keeps people from still imagining, constructing an our kind here, right?
Yes.
And that's kind of the question to me, which gets complicated, is what's our kind? What does that mean? Do we have a rule book,
Well, I was going to say, I can speak from another personal standpoint of going from news anchor to marijuana activist in how I was perceived by my own community. So before I was a news anchor, you know, well-respected, people watch me at 5, 6, and 10 o'clock every evening, love me in the street. And as soon as they know I'm advocating for marijuana, the same people that love me are now going online and calling me a ghetto thug and the, like, things of that nature just constantly. And these are the same people that I grew up with, but I came out as a marijuana activist, and now everything that I built as far as my character is concerned has nothing to do with how they see me and how they see us.
I just want to point out how interesting it is that that's what you got called.
Yeah.
What do people think that most Americans envision when they hear ghetto thug? Right? What do we think most Americans envision when they hear welfare queen? Right? This is holdovers of the 1980s, where street crime, drug use, all of that was attached to people of a certain color. And while, you know, there's a lot to be said for educating people about the plant itself and trying to take away fears of the plant, I think we're kidding ourselves if we're not saying that the fear of the plant is really the fear of the people that are using the plant. And there will always be a different way for politicians to find a way to segment and marginalize the population. And if we don't embrace that and start having a conversation about why did the prohibition happen and why is the criminal justice system the tool that we're using to deal with the fact that we're not investing in education, we're not investing in communities struck by poverty, we're not investing in adequate health care for people, and instead our idea of dealing with the fact that some people get in trouble with substances, a lot of people don't, but some people get in trouble with substances because they're self-medicating, because they're not provided the opportunities that other people are having, that there is already structured inequality in our system, we're just going to keep having the same argument. And, you know, and I know that I'm only speaking for myself necessarily, but if we're only talking about marijuana, we're really missing the boat. What's going to happen when we start talking about cocaine? what's going to start happening when we talk about heroin, about meth? And by the way, there are racist stereotypes that go along with each of these drugs. That is no coincidence. This is at its heart about social control, segmentation, and exclusion.
So I don't want to underestimate the racist application of the drug war. What the drug war accomplished is a disenfranchise tens of thousands of African Americans, particularly in the southern states. And that's changed a lot of, you know, a lot of history in terms of who's elected and not elected.
Oh, and the other thing I wanted to point out, just because Lee made a really good point, and maybe not intentionally when you were talking about LGBT, like if you had opened up a law office about LGBTQ rights, right? So medical marijuana was the first inroads, I think, that we started to make as advocates in the 1970s when we actually got the federal government to open up a compassionate IND program and to allow people to apply to receive marijuana from the government itself. And the reason it got shut down was because the AIDS crisis broke and lots of AIDS patients started applying for the program. And all of a sudden the government, and there's a memo I'm happy to share with anyone, that talks about the concern that gay people would actually start having more irresponsible sex with one another if we gave them marijuana and spreading the disease. So again, it's not about the drug. It's about the people that you're trying essentially to hurt.
Yeah.
I do
Lee, I've got a question from the crowd.
I was just going to say, I did have some good post-legalization news from Oregon. We had a similar experience to the one Charlo described in Washington, in that, you know, we wrote into our law three times not to interfere with the Medical Marijuana Act. And at the very first hearing, the very first thing that the very first legislator said is, now that it's legal, we probably don't need the medical marijuana program anymore. But we were able to make some compromises on that. The good news is we've moved further forward on marijuana law, criminal law reform than any other state so far. And including allowing expungements of virtually all prior marijuana convictions, which is becoming a national thing.
So we've got 5 minutes. I do want to get the couple of people who came up to ask questions to get their questions in. So Joy, let me walk down to you.
I first wanted to thank everybody on the panel for your individual work. Thank each of you. Thank you so much, Allison, for your work, especially and particularly on the national campaign to end mass incarceration. Thank you. Question is for Lee. Move back. Question is for Lee. All right, we're filming. Sorry, Lee. So Grateful Dead tour, hi sweetheart. The early '90s. We could have an entire panel, and perhaps absolutely should have an entire panel on the racial disparity, which deserves its own conference. Absolutely. Grateful Dead tour. It was a different type of an interesting social science situation where we have mostly white people and several college educated. I had at that point my children, my two babies on Dead Tour before Jerry Garcia died. And we would see unbelievable violence. I mean, on a Saratoga Springs show, which is a horse races, all the cops were on horses, and we would literally be on, you know, blankets with our babies after the show. And these cops were coming through 10 at a time on horses, and it was move your fucking babies off the blanket or you're gonna get trampled on. And we would sit there and be like, but wait, why are you doing this to me? I come from a privileged, educated home. I have college education. What are you doing to me? And then we would rise up and we would attack with the media. And oftentimes the media would respond. And one particular one, a terrible event happened in Maryland where we saw actual baby carriages with babies in them. And these were of white people. That were being torn apart by security guards. And that was in Maryland, and we got response from the media there. And then we're watching The Wired and looking what's happened in Baltimore 20 years later, and no response at all. And I wanted your perspective on that interesting piece of how they will attack communities of hippies, and it was kind of like shooting fish in a fishbowl at the Dead shows.
When I think of Dead shows in the early 90s, I think of Operation Dead End and of our brothers and sisters who are in prison for still for LSD offenses. And I hear you about harm reduction for cocaine and for meth, but the next legalization movement ought to be for LSD, in my opinion. That's what I think about. I like to occasionally say publicly, and this seems like a good group to say it in, that I'm a better trial lawyer from having used LSD in my younger days. So, I don't know if that's responsive to your question or not, but that's what it means to me.
I want to make a sort of synthesis really quick, which is one that I don't think that they're disconnected. The structural racism that has constructed the drug war is the same structural racism that creates the possibility for cannabis bigotry to happen. And what I want to say is that historically, that's what, you know, drugs have been, the discourse of drugs have been ascribed to do to white people is turn them into black people, right? So going back to Norman Mailer's essay, The White Negro, The Hipster, it's cultural miscegenation, essentially, that the concept of cultural miscegenation, which is at which you understand that racialization is about difference, it's about color, it's also about color plus other things. And I think what is interesting is we do have the structural story of structural racism, but we're also seeing basically the combination of different kinds of stigmatizations. So the gay cannabis user, the black cannabis user, that it doesn't, it's important to think of these things as multiple and connected processes that create, what we're trying to, and ultimately, everyone knows, what do we do though? What do we do? And I think that we've run out of time, so I'm going to allow anybody that wants to make a final comment from the panel to go ahead and make a final comment.
Just keep talking about it. In my opinion, the more we talk about it, the more people actually, if you can talk about cannabis use, the more normal it will become and the more we'll be able to get over these other hurdles that are kind of more complex, I believe.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say absolutely, and keep encouraging the people around you to keep talking about it. You have to consider this a war. Like, we are fighting for our lives, if not our own, for our children, for our neighbors, for the sick ones in our communities, and we have to not be complacent. And if you're sitting and watching people die, then you're just a part of the problem. So you have to get other people involved. If you have loved ones that aren't speaking out, just ask them, do you feel any differently about me because I use cannabis than what is going on here?
I think being able to share your own stories and experiences about how unharmful it has been to you on a personal level with strangers is a really scary but important thing to do, because if you don't force yourself to have the uncomfortable conversation now, things are just going to get way more uncomfortable when they start taking away everything that we fought for thus far. And you never know who you could be sitting next to, what their experience is, or what they might be able to do to further push the issue or the cause in a positive way. And you're never going to know if you don't open up that conversation. So do it. Throw yourself in uncomfortable situations and talk about it. Talk. Because as a community, the more efforts that we've got, pushing this boulder, it's just going to make it easier for everybody in the long run.
Thank you, Stephanie. Allison?
Yeah, I think everything that they've said is 100% right. It's all about having the conversation. It's all about telling your own truth and not being afraid to say, I don't know the answers, but I would really like to be engaged in a conversation with you about how we might come up with answers together. Don't be afraid to not know. How do you deal with the big, complex questions? But just say, I'm troubled by them. Can we talk about it and work together to find those solutions?
I just want to leave on a happy note. The good news is that, speaking as the old man on the panel, that the kids are all right. That if you are 35 years old or younger, upwards of 80% of the people get it on this issue. They get it on gay marriage. They get it on a host of issues. A lot of this change is just, and a lot of these problems are just temporal. And I guess the other thing is, just to get back to what I said earlier, there really are too few of us for infighting. More love, less attitude. Let's work together. Let's get her done. Thanks.
Excellent. Thanks, panel. Awesome discussion.